From Illinois to Arizona, Ohio to Nebraska, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, trade talks between the United States and China appear to be making progress. Veronique DeRugi of the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here with an update. It is billed by congressional Democrats as campaign finance reform, but it is really a politician protection act. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth has the real story. Recycling is viewed as good for the environment, but many small cities and towns are dropping their recycling programs. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine is here to tell us why. And video of Bernie Sanders partying with the Soviets in Russia back in 1988 has surfaced. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values discusses the impact on this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. The Trump administration's efforts to hammer out a new trade deal with China appear to be at a critical point, although there are signs that progress is being made. Here to discuss the ongoing trade negotiations is Veronique DeRugi. Veronique is a senior research fellow for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. Veronique, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Veronique, before we get into what China policy really needs to be in terms of having a pro-growth agenda for our country, tell us a little bit about the background. How did we get to where we are, and where do things stand in the ongoing negotiations between the Trump administration and China relative to trade?
The situation with China started when, in March last year, when the Trump administration announced an across-the-board increase steel and aluminum tariffs, right? And that included a lot of our NATO allies and China. And then there were retaliatory tariffs put on by those foreign nations as a result of the steel and aluminum tariffs. And then over the summer, the Trump administration announced that it would use another tool in its toolkit, in its protectionist toolkit, to impose tariffs on a large number of Chinese imports. Worth noting, a lot of them are input, like steel and aluminum, that American manufacturers use in their production in the U.S. And then the battle continued. China imposed retaliatory tariffs, stopped buying stuff from the U.S. And now here we are with, there was a deadline of March 1st to increase the existing China tariff from 10% to 25%. And that was like the condition, like they need to be a deal before this. And the president just announced, like I think last week, that he would suspend the increase of these tariffs until they find a deal, because he believed that they were really, really, really close to finding a deal. So that's pretty much where we are. So they're trying to kind of iron out a deal that is acceptable for both sides. And if that doesn't happen, there's going to be an increase in the tariffs on China from 10% to 25%.
In terms of the deal, Veronique, that the Trump administration is working on, what are the goals? What is it that we're actually looking for? Particularly, what are we looking for that would change the playing field from what has happened in the past?
I can tell you what I think the administration wants. They want structural reforms. Basically, they want the Chinese political class to move away from state capitalism, which means like basically a lot of subsidies going through their state-owned enterprises. They want more market access for American goods. They want an agreement on IP theft, intellectual property thefts, that's happening. So that's kind of the main line. And it looks like the Chinese are willing to open more their market. They have stopped using the terms made in China, which was like this big kind of industrial policy, but I don't know that the policy really has changed. They are making progress, it appears, on IP theft, and the Chinese have actually agreed to buy much more American products through their state-owned enterprise, which to me is a contradiction with the goal of having them be more capitalist country than this state capitalism type of thing that we see, because effectively, if you demand as part of the agreement that they actually use their state-owned enterprises to buy artificially more products, that's just entrenching China in its old model.
As we look at this, as you've mentioned, if an agreement is not reached, then these tariffs, particularly on steel and aluminum, are going to take a very large jump. Conversely, if there is an agreement, Veronique, are we going to look to see those tariffs either be reduced or perhaps vanish entirely?
So there are questions of whether the Chinese are going to stick to the deal that they will agree to. And so a lot of people are talking about actually maintaining the tariffs until they prove that they're implementing the change in policy. But also it is worth noting that even in the past where the president has actually used raising tariffs to get a change in agreement, like it was the case to renegotiate NAFTA, right? The president has said many times that the reason why tariffs went up on steel and aluminum products, even for Canada and Mexico, it was ordered to use as leverage to force Canada and Mexico to renegotiate NAFTA. When NAFTA has been renegotiated, and then the metal tariffs are still there. And so, I mean, it's really unclear. I mean, the president has called himself tariff man, and he said many times, he's like, he personally really likes tariffs. So it's really unclear.
As we look at those tariffs, and as you pointed out, they've been put on particularly steel and aluminum in Canada, in Mexico, China. What has the impact been on goods in the United States? Because we utilize a lot of those raw materials. Has it had an upward impact on prices?
Yes, absolutely. So there are two academic studies that came out. So first, I mean, it's important to understand that the reason why free market people don't like tariffs and don't like protectionist measures in general is because actually we know that raising tariffs unilaterally never lead to forcing other countries to lower their tariffs. In the end, they retaliate, and we end up with more tariffs across the board. And by the way, this is what we are observing now. And the other thing is that it's an import tax, and I understand that people like the people in the Trump administration believe that these are going to be shouldered by the Chinese companies sending their goods over, but we understand that actually the burden is shifted to consumers, and those consumers are American consumers. And by consumers, it doesn't mean necessarily you and I. What it means is actually people who are manufacturers using these products in their production of American goods.
We have been talking with Veronique Larugi, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, located at George Mason University. Veronique, tell us a bit about the Mercatus Center, and where can folks go to read more?
The Mercatus Center is a university-based research center, and we're in Arlington, Virginia, which is right outside of D.C. We're in the George Mason University. We're at George Mason University, and we do economic issues. We started as basically mostly focusing on regulation. For a long time, it was kind of our bread and butter, and since we've expanded in a lot of other areas like budget and taxes and local governments and trade policy, and things like this. And you can find pretty much everything we write on the Mercatus.org.
Veronique Larugi of the Mercatus Center. As always, Veronique, good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C. We have activity in Congress, and we have activity out in congressional districts as well, with some special elections and a new website from the Club for Growth. We're going to talk about all of that. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Loman.
Let's start out in the U.S. House of Representatives. There's something called H.R. 1. It is being billed by the left as campaign finance reform. As usual, the left comes up with a clever, nice, apple pie-sounding name, but it isn't what it would appear to be. Tell us a bit about it.
H.R. 1 is the Democrats' basic messaging bill that they want to tell the American people. It's the first bill that they filed in the year, what they're going to do if they get the House, Senate, and White House. And while they want to call this voter registration reform and campaign finance reform. Really what it is Nancy Pelosi's crackdown on free political speech. So what we're seeing here is Democrats proposing legislation that would stifle political speech by limiting your right to criticize elected officials. Is this what voters had in mind when they gave Democrats a new House majority in November? We don't think so. So in previous instances, Republicans have used H.R. 1 as the legislative vehicle for historic tax cuts. President Obama used H.R. 1 for the Recovery and Reinvestment Act, also known as the Obama stimulus. And what the Democrats are calling H.R. 1 is For the People Act. We think that this dangerous legislation is anything but for the people. We're calling it for the politicians. And here's why. Political speech by certain disfavored groups would totally be restricted. The legislation seeks to regulate groups that want to inform voters on what Congress is doing, and it would politicize election regulations by eliminating the current bipartisan composition on the Federal Election Commission, making it instead a partisan body. If we have partisan decisions being made at the FEC, what does that mean when you've got a crackdown on a certain political group that wants to do campaign spending? We thought that it was bad with Lois Lerner at the IRS. This could be way, way, way worse. The legislation would effectively dismantle the First Amendment by requiring super PACs to make all their donors public. And if you think about this, right now there are some disclosure requirements that large donors have to reveal what their contributions are through these political groups. But this would be, even if you're a small donor and you're giving $5 or $100, your name would be made public, and you are effectively having to say out loud what political activity you're supporting. And we think that that is restricting political speech and an inherent right within the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. Finally, I guess I would kind of conclude talking about H.R. 1 that we're calling this political welfare for the politicians because it would subsidize, through taxpayer funding, small-dollar donations. So, Lohman, if you gave a candidate $100, the federal government would give that candidate $600 in taxpayer money. And if you think about it, that's not really what we stand for as a nation, having taxpayer funding go to candidates that we politically oppose, we ideologically oppose. We think it's unacceptable. We think it's political welfare for politicians, and that's why this isn't the For the People Act, it's the For the Politicians Act.
It, of course, will then have to go over to the United States Senate, where Mitch McConnell says he's not even going to bring it to the floor for a vote. So we'll keep an eye to see whether or not he sticks to that or what might happen going forward. Let's switch now for a couple of minutes, Scott, and talk about special congressional elections. There are three open seats, but one in particular, there's been some activity. This in Pennsylvania's 12th Congressional District, a sprawling rural district in the north central part of Pennsylvania around Williamsport. Republicans have come up with a candidate. What's happening there?
Last weekend, there was a convention in Pennsylvania 12 to determine who the Republican nominee would be in the special election, which is occurring in late May. The Club for Growth went ahead and interviewed some of the candidates. I think that there were over 20 that were officially running, but only 14 got nominated last weekend during the convention. There were, I think, good candidates in the Pennsylvania field for the race, and the person that emerged is State Representative Fred Keller, and we've talked with him, but we're going to bring him back in before we decide whether or not we're going to make an endorsement.
Fred Keller, of course, one of the more conservative members of the Pennsylvania General Assembly. So we'll see what happens there. This district, by the way, is very heavily Republican. Although, Scott, as we've seen in the past, sometimes these special elections with the national spotlight can become competitive where normally they are not. So we'll keep an eye on that. Also, a couple of open seats where there will be special elections in North Carolina. We'll talk about that in future weeks. Before we end, Scott, the Club for Growth has a new website, and it's very exciting. So tell us a bit about that.
The Club for Growth is working on an education effort related to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. And what we have done is launched a brand new website called economicarmageddon.com. And that's a part of our educational effort to highlight the disastrous policies contained within the Green New Deal. We put a significant five-figure digital ad buy behind the targeted areas nationwide that we want to educate the voters. And the video is called The Goal is Control. And it actually plays off of a sort of a fun historical campaign ad that I think some of your listeners may be familiar with, the Daisy ad that Lyndon Johnson ran in the 60s. And so we would encourage everybody to check out that website, economicarmageddon.com, watch the web ad, and share it widely. We think that certainly the Green New Deal will impact every industry in America and be a disaster for our economy, dumping us into a permanent depression. And so we'd see super hyperinflation. We'd see wages, and the dollar wouldn't be worth anything, frankly, Loman. That's what's at stake here, and we need to ensure that the Green New Deal is defeated.
And we're going to talk more about this website and the Green New Deal as we move forward with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We have over 250,000 members nationwide from all walks of life and including all 50 states in the union. Our group is united because we believe in economic freedom. And if your listeners are interested, they can go to our website, www.clubforgrowth.org, and if they like what they see, they can join for free. I'd also encourage everybody to check us out on Twitter, @club4growth, Club for Growth.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Many small cities and towns across the United States are discontinuing their curbside recycling programs, and for good reason. Eric Bame of Reason Magazine has details.
Should that empty soda bottle go in the recycling bin or the trash can? Increasingly, it doesn't really matter. It's all going to end up in the landfill anyway. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Bame with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. Today, we're taking a closer look at why some towns across America, mostly smaller towns, but some cities too, are finding it more and more difficult to fund their recycling programs. And that was the subject of a long piece that appeared in The Atlantic this week at Atlantic.com, headlined, Is This the End of Recycling? And the underlying story here actually has to do with China. You actually have to go back to the end of 2017. That's when China decided to restrict how much foreign trash or recycling that it was going to buy. Because before that, a large portion of America's plastic and paper waste used to go from our recycling bins to factories in China, where it was melted down and otherwise refashioned into everything from shoes to plastic bags, to new plastic products, toys, all sorts of things. But China's decision to cut off how much it was buying has really changed the economics of recycling. And so as a result, this piece that The Atlantic had this week looked at how some American cities and towns are now making the difficult decision to send all of those recyclables directly to the landfill. In Franklin, New Hampshire, for example, a curbside recycling program that launched back in 2010 was able to break even for a while because the town was selling its used paper and metals and plastics for about $6 per ton. But now the town is being charged about $125 per ton to recycle the same stuff. And instead of asking residents to pay much higher prices to recycle or cutting other city services in order to be able to afford the increasingly expensive recycling program, city officials have decided instead to send those recyclables to an incinerator, which costs significantly less. The Atlantic also profiled towns in Idaho, in New York State, and in Virginia, and elsewhere that have had to make similar choices in recent months. And the sudden shift in the market really has less to do with China than it does with some of the underlying issues with American recycling. In fact, part of it has to do with the American fascination with recycling, because there aren't many other countries around the world that try to recycle as many variety of items as we do, especially things that aren't economically viable to recycle or reuse. Even as municipal recycling programs became almost ubiquitous in America over the past few decades, the underlying infrastructure has remained both economically and environmentally flawed. Whenever the topic of recycling comes up, I go back to this 2015 piece that John Tierney wrote in the New York Times, an op-ed. It predicted many of the problems that the municipalities highlighted in this week's Atlantic story are now dealing with, including the slumping demand for recycled goods that has been brought on in part by lower oil prices that make it a lot cheaper to just manufacture new things. In that 2015 op-ed at the New York Times, John Tierney wrote that recycling has been a relentlessly promoted goal in an of itself as an unalloyed public good and private virtue that is indoctrinated in students from kindergarten through college, and as a result, otherwise well-informed and educated people have no idea about the relative costs and benefits. And then he goes on to break down some of those costs and benefits, and he's exactly right. It's not something we really ever think about. We're told to reduce and reuse and recycle, but we never think about the process for recycling. And in fact, Tierney identified many of those same problems two decades earlier, all the way back in 1996, when he authored a much longer takedown of the American recycling regime for the New York Times magazine. In that piece, he argued that recycling may be the most wasteful activity in modern America. It's a waste of time and money and a waste of human and natural resources. As Tierney noted in that 1996 piece, all of the trash generated by Americans for the next 1,000 years would fit into a landfill space that takes up less than 1% of the land currently used for grazing animals. And even better, modern methods of landfilling mean that you can mitigate many of the environmental hazards that used to be part of the process. That means the land can be reused for parks or for grazing animals or for building baseball and tennis stadiums. The New York Mets play in a stadium that's literally built on top of a landfill, and you can make your own joke about what that means for the team. But that's not to say that recycling is all bad or that it should never be done. There are certainly cost-effective ways to recycle and reuse some common goods. Aluminum, for example, actually there's a pretty viable market there for recycled aluminum, and even for paper in some circumstances. But Tierney's view, and the reality that's now facing many American cities with expensive recycling programs, is that the benefits of recycling have been overstated for years and the costs never clearly understood. To understand them, I think we have to think about how a simple municipal recycling program works. You've probably got a few guys riding around town on a big truck to collect all that plastic and aluminum and paper waste. So you've got to pay those guys, of course. You have to buy that truck. You have to maintain it and put gas in it, which means you're creating more greenhouse gases every time you drive it around to collect the recyclables. Then you have to pay people to dig through all of those recyclable goods and decide what's actually usable and what's not. About 25% of what enters the recycling stream is too contaminated to actually be useful, according to the National Waste and Recycling Association. Then you have to use more trucks and barges and trains to get it wherever it needs to go to actually be recycled. The paper has to be pulped, which requires heat and water, and that heat is possibly provided by a coal or natural gas-powered power plant, which means there's more greenhouse emissions right there. And the same is true for plastic, which has to be washed with hot water and then melted down before it can be reused. The bottom line is that Americans are really good at buying stuff, and many consumer goods are now cheaper than ever, and that means we create a lot of waste. In fact, we create 60% more of it now than we did in 1985. But this is actually a very good sort of problem to have. People living in poor countries don't have the luxury of worrying about recycling or landfilling the things that they can't afford to buy in the first place. And we're also just not very good at recycling, despite all those decades of advocacy campaigns. The Environmental Protection Agency says only about 9.5% of the plastic generated in 2014 was actually recycled that year, with 75% of it ending up in landfills. Like most other civic issues, recycling programs should be judged by their cost and their benefits. And that means taking an honest assessment of those cost and benefits, one that leaves out the social signaling of environmentalism and the feel-good benefits of putting an empty Coke bottle in a plastic bin that's painted blue instead of a trash can that's black or gray. There's no need to recycle all the things all the time, and the market seems to be sending a pretty powerful signal about the benefits of just calling trash what it is. It's just trash. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm.
He serves in the U.S. Senate as a socialist, so it might not be surprising that video of Bernie Sanders partying with communists in the USSR back in the 1980s has surfaced. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values at Grove City College has this American Radio Journal commentary.
Amazing footage has been posted by the veteran left-wing magazine Forward. The video comes from Bernie Sanders' honeymoon to the Soviet Union in 1988. The footage shows a literally shirtless Bernie partying like a frat boy and swilling booze with the Bolshies while singing, "This land is your land." Seriously. The video is striking. It's a surreal scene, evincing a primordial ambiance, a room that must have smelled not only of bare-chested, cavemanish communism, but of Stoli vodka, sausages, and body odor. Bernie's band of democratic socialists will, naturally, find marvelously creative ways to excuse the spectacle. They'll try to turn the whole smelly thing against Bernie's detractors. Any rascally Republican who cries foul over the footage will be denounced as a modern-day Joe McCarthy. Hey, the left is the left. Liberals would throw a hissy fit if video was found of Elizabeth Warren in Indian headdress dancing the Kalinka at a vodka party in the Kremlin. But again, this Bernie gem was posted by Forward, with the eye-catching title, "Footage of Shirtless Bernie Sanders Drunkenly Singing with the Soviets in 88 Surfaces." And why is this significant, beyond the obvious? Well, let me offer some historical context. Bernie married his current wife, Jane, in 1988, and the two then headed for Mother Russia. They honeymooned in the USSR. Bernie later dismissed as silly and absurd the notion that the trip revealed him as, quote, some type of communist sympathizer, unquote. Yes, why would anyone think that? Nothing in Bernie's past would raise red flags. For the record, in this same period, Bernie made pilgrimage to Cuba and Nicaragua to bask in the triumphs of La Revolución there. A few years prior, in 1980, when normal Americans were choosing between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan for president, Bernie tossed his support to the Socialist Workers' Party, where he was a formal presidential elector in 1980. Not a lot had changed from the good old days. After growing up in Brooklyn, Bernie began spreading his socialist wings, first landing at what ex-communist Ron Radosh described as a Stalinist kibbutz in Israel in 1963. After that, Sanders went to the University of Chicago. There, he worked with the Young People's Socialist League, YPSL. And so, when it was noted during the 2016 campaign that Bernie had honeymooned in the USSR 1 year before the Berlin Wall fell, well, more than a few Americans had their suspicions. And yet, Bernie's cronies would sneer at such suspicions. They barked that this was a mere fact-finding trip, so essential to the good commerce of Mayor Sanders' Burlington enclave. How dare anyone think this was anything but good business practice? Well, as they say, let's go to the videotape. Take a look for yourself. Bernie seems to be intoxicated by the Soviet environs. Nyet, our progressive friends will shout at us. That's a bunch of red-baiting borscht. Angry progressives can add this latest calumny to their list of lamentable examples of poor Sanders being red-baited by pig-headed right-wingers who just don't understand the wonders of democratic socialism. No doubt, Bernie and Bride went to Moscow to preach free markets, a business transaction. Yeah, that's it. Imagine thinking anything else. Oh, and as for you liberals who say this stuff doesn't matter, that this is just silliness, innocent, well, ask yourselves this. Would you say that if video was found of a shirtless, drunk Donald Trump partying up with the Russians? I bet not, comrade. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my books, Dupes and the Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, KEDU-FM in Ruidoso, New Mexico. Welcome to our new listeners in the land of enchantment. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.